Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. My name is Imam Alfred. Religion means a lot. We have been resurrected, and thank God we are here as a program to help the general public. Our particular interest is to African Americans. From African Americans from Rio de Janeiro to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and we spread all over the globe, we're interested in humanity. However, our focus is the African American that's been a victim of the worst treatment known to human being called slavery. And the African Americans from North America, from Florida to Maine, has gotten the worst dose of this poison. But let's not kid ourselves. Everybody has gotten it. Those who even gave it got it. So we are very privileged and especially honored to have with us Dr. Abdul Rahman. Dr. Rahman is not a DD. He doesn't have a DD in. The DDN, some of you might know, is the doctor of denigrification. He actually has a PhD degree from Temple University. And prior to that, a master's from Lincoln University, two stellar universities in the state of Pennsylvania. Welcome, doctor, to Religion Means Alive.
As-salamu alaykum. Thank you.
Wa alaykum salam. Would you like to give us an opening statement before I start asking you questions? And you all would like to join the show, like to ask questions, and we may have a few spaces. Later on, we'll open up the phone lines. But I want Dr. Rahman just give us an opening statement. Tell us, Dr. Rahman, were you born in the citadel of the academy, a bucolic, idyllic environment?
No.
What is your background in? How did you come to be Professor Dr. Abdul Rahman with a fully accredited doctorate degree? And I must say, I don't knock online degrees, but you actually sat in a classroom and gotten a master's degree. I happen to know the master's program that you went to, graduated from, didn't just go to. I went there at Lincoln University and the doctoral program at the Temple University. So tell us, who is Dr. Abdul Rahman? And we want to know whether he was born in a mansion on top of the hill with golf courses overlooking it, and probably a boat by the ocean. Is that Dr. Abdul Rahman? Most doctorates have those kinds of backgrounds.
Well, let me first say that I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and he asked me what my major was, and I told him initially my major was urban pharmaceuticals. Because I grew up on the streets of Philadelphia. I was originally raised in East Orange, New Jersey, until I was 14, and then I moved to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And in Philadelphia, I got caught up when I was 15. I was about 15 years old. I started selling drugs. Got caught up in what most people call that street life, and from time I was 15 to the time I was 24, and then eventually I was arrested and sent to Greatest for a prison for 10 years, from 24 to 34. While in prison, let me first say I was in the Nation of Islam initially when I went to prison, and while in prison.
Can I ask you a question? I just want to interrupt you about. You were in the Nation of Islam, and you said after the Nation of Islam, you got involved in street life. How did that come to be?
No. I got involved in the street life first, and eventually, even being part of the street life, I ended up in the Nation of Islam. And at that time, in the Nation of Islam in Philadelphia, there was people who brought the street life, and I was one of them that brought the street life into the Nation of Islam with them. You know what I mean? Okay. So, you know, we kind of corrupted the religion. You know, we tried to play both sides of the, you know, both ends against the middle. You know what I mean? So we we wanted to do what's right and live right and follow the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. But we also wanted to make that money. You know what I mean? So so what happened was eventually, you know, I was arrested and I went to prison in 1976. In 1975, Elijah Muhammad passed away, and his son, Warfi Muhammad, at that time, Wawazi Muhammad, which you know, took over the leadership of the Nation of Islam. And
yes, sir.
What he did was he brought in a whole new concept of not only just Islam, but how to read scripture, how to interpret scripture, and he kind of took the religious literature and religious scripture and grew it up into a situation where we could understand it as laymen, so to speak. So, but what happened was I was in that transition from the Nation of Islam to the leadership of Imam W.D. Muhammad. And during that transition, that's when I first went to prison. So I had a lot of time to sit and read and study the Imam's teachings. And one of the things, and I know you're going to get on the subject of my book, Solving the Riddle, but one of the reasons why I named the book Solving the Riddle, because believe it or not, Imam Muhammad used to speak to us, and you know it, I'm preaching to the choir here. He used to speak to us in riddles. He used to give us riddles. Like, he used to say things like man means mind, words make people, things of that nature. And if you could solve that riddle, you basically had an idea of where the Imam was trying to take us. So when they talk about rehabilitation in the prisons and all that, I'm going to be honest with you, brother. Those three words, man means mind. Once I understood what that meant, the concept of what that meant, and what the Imam where he was trying to take us, my rehabilitation was immediate. You know, when you go to prison, you spend the first 3 months. At that time, you spend the first 3 months on what they call quarantine. So they evaluate you, see how you're going to adjust to prison life, and they determine which state prison they're going to send you in. And then you get the general population after 3 months. Well, what happened was I was in the law clinic every day when I was in quarantine trying working on my case. And one of the gentlemen in the law clinic had a cassette tape. And somehow several of the Imam's early lectures were smuggled into the prison. And the brother used to let me hold the tape overnight. And I used to just get in there and study the Imam's lectures. And again, by the time I made it to population, which was 3 months, I was rehabilitated. I didn't even need prison no more. What happened is I didn't know where I was going, but I knew where I wasn't going. You follow? Does that make sense to you? Hello?
Brother Imam, can you hear me? Evening. We are back on the air. We had some troubles with the program. I don't know what the technical problems are, but we are back on the air. We're waiting for our dear brother, Brother Kevin, Dr. Kevin Abdul-Rahman, to call back in. And as soon as he calls back in, we are going to do. This is Blog Talk Radio. Religion means alive. We don't expect to have anything easy. Nothing is going to be given to us. So we expect challenges in life. And certainly this is a challenge. Yes. So we're waiting for Brother Kevin Abdul-Rahman. He's back with us. And
hello.
Anyway, yes, sir. You're back on the air, Brother Doctor Kevin. I thought there was some street pharmacology. Maybe there was some street interference. But we you know, we are people of faith, and we're going to keep working and to do what we have to do. So just finish. We started from the coming into the Nation of Islam and having one foot in the street and one foot in the grave. I'm going to wonder and ask you a question. Was that common in the Nation of Islam in Philadelphia?
We'll say that again.
Was it common in the Nation of Islam in Philadelphia?
No, it wasn't.
Maybe
common.
Others.
It was a small percentage of people. It was a small percentage of us. But the average believer was a law abiding citizen. It was just percentage of us. You know what I mean?
I'm glad you cleared that up. Because there's a misconception going around that the Nation of Islam
took them. I know that there's a lot of people who think the whole city was corrupt, but that's not true. There was just a few of us who, you know, wanted to burn the candle from both ends. You know what I mean?
And you know what? To be very fair, Doctor, we had that in quite a few other cities. So it's not to say that it doesn't have you. Anytime you have human beings, not everybody going to get it at one time. There are going to be people who are mixed. So that's no reflection on Temple Number 12. It's just a reflection on the challenges that urban life is. Urban life is very difficult. I want to now go a little bit to your personal background prior to you moving to Philadelphia. Because in the book, The Riddle, it is a lot about your personal background. You had played sports, and just share a little bit of that with us first. Let's get free Philadelphia.
I just like most kids, you know, I was raised by my grandmother in East Orange, New Jersey, and I got, you know, my first love of my life was Pop Warner football, so I got involved with Pop Warner football when I was, I guess, 6, 7, 8 years old, and all the way up till 13 when you could no longer play. 13 was the age limit. And I guess you would say a normal life of a kid growing up in an urban city. You know, sports took over. Sports was probably 90% of my life. No, I would say 75% of my life. The other 25% was my grandmother had me in church every evening. So, you know, I didn't have much wiggle room between school, sports, and church. You know what I mean?
Was that a good life at that time?
Yeah, I would say so. I would say so. Mm-hmm. I would say that.
Did you grow up in a Baptist, Pentecostal, or what type of?
Pentecostal.
Okay.
Alpha and Omega Tabernacle on Bluefield Avenue in Montclair. It's no longer there now. They closed down. But anyway, no, it was a good life for me. I didn't, you know, my grandmother was so frugal. I didn't know we were poor. I didn't know we were poor until I was an adult, because you know whatever your needs were met. You know what I mean? You might have to wear cardboard in your sneakers there, but you still had on some sneakers. You know what I mean?
Yes. So, did you have brothers and sisters?
I have two sisters and I have a brother. My brother and I, when my father and mother got divorced, my mother took the girls and my grandmother took the boys. So my brother and I, we grew up in East Orange, and my two sisters went to Philly with my mother.
Okay. And what was that like to be moving from bucolic, idyllic Montclair and Pop Warner football to urban Philadelphia? I think you got a rude awakening when you got into Philadelphia. I want to talk a little bit about set the stage
What happened. The first day of school in Philadelphia, you're talking about a culture shock. You know the very first thing I had to do my first day of school?
When I got to Philly,
tell me what that was.
I had to go into the boys' bathroom and box somebody hard to the body.
Wow.
I had to do that before I could go to class.
Wow.
So it was a very, yes, it was a total 180-degree something. It's almost like this coronavirus. It was something I had never seen before. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because at that mm-hmm. time in the 60s, Philadelphia was very, had a very bad gang problem. There was a lot of gangs.
Mm-hmm.
So you could your world was probably about a 4-block radius before you were in another
mm-hmm.
gang territory. So, I don't know how much more of a culture shock you can have from playing Pop Warner football to you got to box somebody in the boys' bathroom before you go to their first class.
What would have happened if you hadn't boxed that brother?
I probably would have got bullied for the rest of my life.
Wow. So that was what they call baptism by fire, a baptism by fist.
Yeah, it was baptism by fire for sure. You know what I mean?
Now, let me ask you, you have done a lot of youth counseling. And I'm kind of jumping around again. But I want to stay with this because we're going to have to do this probably in 4 parts. What would you tell a young pre-Dr. Kevin if he were in that situation? Because, I mean, that's a big problem with young men in particular who are scared to go to school because they're being bullied. Could you speak to that problem?
Well, one of the things that you cannot create a criminal or a criminal mind without robbing that individual of their humanity. So the first thing, and everything I'm saying to you, I'm really parroting Imam W.D. Muhammad.
Yes, sir.
So the first thing I had to do, even when I was in prison, the first thing I had to do was to regain my humanity. Because you just can't create a criminal, if you don't take your humanity. You know, things like love, kindness, justice, peace, honesty, respect, openness, loyalty, equality, all those characteristics are part of your humanity. So if you don't receive those messages, that kind of information from your environment, you probably won't hold those qualities in high standard. So I would say my first thing to say is that with young people in particular, you have to help them understand what it means to have your humanity, what it means to be a human being. And again, I will tell you this over and over. You cannot create a criminal if that individual maintains their humanity. So like the boxing in the body and all that, once you humiliate a person, you know what I mean, that's an attempt to rob them of their humanity. So I would say the first step you would take is to try to help young people understand their humanity and what it means to be a human being and what responsibilities come with being a human being.
Humanity. I agree with you. I want to revisit an experience you had. Now the book is coming back to me clearly. As I think about it, I can almost remember the point where I was at in my bed when I was reading it, or in my room. When you talk about when you were playing ball and you had an unfair incident with one of the coaches, and you had really loved the sport and you thought you were being treated unfairly, was that a part of the beginning of your humanity being taken away from you?
I won't say my humanity taken from me. But it was a cultural how could I put this? It was a cultural thing that a 13-year-old could not understand. You know what I mean? Because you were taught if you're better than the next guy, then you're going to be the starter. You follow what I'm saying? So we had a cultural situation where a Caucasian guy came down from West Orange to coach the East Orange Tigers, who was basically an all-African-American team. And I was, you know, I was the starting quarterback. And a lot of times in sports, a new coach will try to create his own culture. And his way of doing that is to take the superstar, the star quarterback, or whoever, whatever sport you're playing, and demote them. And that's what happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a situation where it's asking too much of a 13-year-old to understand the cultural dynamics of America in the 60s.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
It probably created, as the imam said, a troublemaker in my subconscious, and it probably,
mm-hmm.
you know, created a dichotomy in me where I was, you know, torn and torn between not being able to understand and between not being able to understand and what my expectations of life had been up to that point.
Yes. So in other words, you saw a degree of unfairness, and that kind of precedes already someone being unfair to you or certainly challenging your humanity in that in the locker room, I mean the bathroom, at the Philadelphia school. But lucky you were blessed, you were physically fit, and you had a physical presence. I mean, you're not a small guy. What do you think would have happened if you had been a smaller guy and didn't know how to defend?
Oh, I was, brother. I was the smallest guy around. I didn't get the guy you met wasn't. I wasn't always this size. The guy you met.
Yes, sir.
So, no, I was all. My mother told me from the time I was 10 to the time I was 15, I wore the same size clothes. You know what I mean?
Wow.
So I was pretty small from growing up.
But
you
had a
lot of heart.
What we call in the streets is you had a lot of heart. Because, I mean, I've seen some small guys whoop some big guys. Because it's a question of heart and courage. So you were always courageous.
I might have even had a Napoleon complex. I don't know. You know?
Well, I tell you, this is good stuff. Let's move now. We move it around a little bit. You're now moving out of Bloomfield. You're now in Philadelphia. You're kind of fighting your way into school. You've been initiated there, and you're letting them know you're not a chump. Go from there to becoming a pharmacist. How do you end up becoming a street pharmacist?
Well, what happened was I ended up going to Philly, and I was a pretty good basketball too, so I ended up making the basketball team. And, you know, once got on the basketball team, everything was fine. But when basketball season was over, you know, life really didn't have a purpose. Once you take a young athlete, sports away from a young athlete, you know, they kind of wander around and don't have purpose. And you're
mm-hmm.
talking about
mm-hmm.
now, you're talking about a 14-year-old that, you know, really the whole purpose in life was about sports. And now you're not playing sports anymore. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're susceptible to other influences.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened to me. You know, I was susceptible to negative influences, and I ended up at the age of 15 selling drugs.
And how did you end up getting into selling drugs?
Well, you know, as far as the streets are concerned, you don't just automatically just one day wake up and say, I'm going to sell drugs. You get slowly
right.
introduced to things. You know, you might start drinking wine, then you end up smoking reefer, then you end up doing something else or whatever. So you're slowly introduced to a different culture.
This is a big question. Would you support the legalization of pot? You just said that pot and wine leads to other things, or possibly leads to other things. Let's ask you.
Well, that's not a fair question to me because I'm a Muslim first, and I have to go by my the dictates of my religion. So from a mm-hmm. religious standpoint, no intoxicants are acceptable. I understand that too.
We have a primarily an audience that is a non-Muslim audience, and that's why I'm answering the question. I follow the same dictate,
let me finish my point. So from a personal standpoint, from my religious background, I would say no. But culturally, growing up in America, and the different political atmospheres that occur, I would say that with the way this crime bill went under, what was it, Clinton, I believe, or whatever, when people were going to jail for a gram of cocaine, I see when you get into the political aspects of it, now you got to talk about the evils and the lesser of evils or whatever. So from that standpoint, I don't have a problem with marijuana being legalized. I would not use it myself, but and I hope I'm not confusing you.
I think we take the
We all have a dichotomy within us. We have our own individual cultural life, and then we have the American culture. And sometimes those two conflict. You follow what
right.
I'm saying?
Exactly what you're saying.
I would not really argue that point with someone in the society, in the secular society. I would not argue that point with them. It would never be for me from a personal standpoint.
Yes. I basically take the position that drugs is addiction is a medical problem and should be probably decriminalized, while I would never sanction the use of it for religious and for just social, psychological things. I've seen what it done. I've been a victim of the devastation that it has caused. So I'm not going to ever, and I had family members, so I don't, from a social point of view, I would never accept. But yet, at the same time, I have to take this position. I'm not for people being locked up for 27 years for it either.
Disease. You have to understand
that's what I said. Drug addiction is a disease. Yeah. And
so
it should be treated medically.
So you can't criminalize a disease.
Now, what you also think, the sale of drugs is almost a disease too. Because I know people who say they don't use it, but they're addicted to selling it. Would you agree with that?
They're addicted to the lifestyle.
You can take a
kid and tell him he can make $200,000 a year selling drugs, or you'll give him a job making $200,000 a year, and a lot of them will choose the selling drugs because of the lifestyle, even though they will be making the same kind of money in the legitimate world. But
we have the example of Pee Wee Kirkland. Pee Wee Kirkland was a guy that was could have been a national renowned basketball player, but instead decided to to play a lifestyle there. I just want to get, because it's not often on Religion Means a Lie that we get an opportunity to talk with someone who's an educated scholar and also a person with treatment. The first time I met you, I knew you were a thinker. And I mean, you don't just get PhD degrees from Temple University. That's not giving them out. And I was in the Lincoln University's Master's in Human Services program, and they're not giving them out. That's a very tough program. So you've earned your stripes. I mean, that's no question about it. You don't, it's not something that we're playing with. It's real. Now we talk about the gradualism, and I'm sorry for going back and forth because, you know, there's so much to talk about, but at the same time, I try not to have an opinion on these programs, but sometimes it's necessary because we're talking to the general public. The problem I have is a lot of times on Muslim programs, the Muslim program is only talking to Muslims. They're not talking to the general public. So that's why
right.
we call our program Religion Means a Lie. We got that from Imam Muhammad because we want to make religion be taken beyond symbols and rituals to what it really is.
Exactly.
And people have insight, sight
exactly.
as to how they can have a better life. Whether they become Muslim,
right.
Christian, or remain whatever they are. We want to make their lives better, especially our people. There's somebody in Jamaica hurting us now, or will hurt us. Somebody in Trinidad, maybe get them to roll up a joint and get them to sell some drugs or pick up a gun. We're hoping they will be touched by your story, which is not a glorious story, but it ends with a great triumph of the human spirit by you solving the riddle. So I want you to continue on by talking about your experience in Philly. You're in the high school. How'd you come to meet up with the Nation of Islam?
Well, I was a teenager in the 60s, and the two biggest influences on me was Muhammad Ali converting to Islam and of course, Malcolm. So, I would say probably the biggest thing for me coming into the Nation of Islam that drew my attention to the Nation of Islam was Muhammad Ali converting to Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
from that point on, it drew me into having interest in the Nation of Islam. And so that's how I ended up in the Nation of Islam. As someone influenced by Muhammad Ali and listening to, in fact, it's funny because I write in my book, I'm in the Riddle. I went to the Nation of Islam, when I first started going to the Temple number 12, it was in 1967. Malcolm had already been killed. And I mentioned in my book how it was a very traumatic for me. I don't know in my head how I resolved it, because when I went to the Nation of Islam, they never called Malcolm by his name. They called him the hypocrite. When I first went in the Nation of Islam, I never heard Malcolm referred to as Malcolm X. He was always referred to as the hypocrite. Yet,
yes.
He was a major influence on the reason why I wanted to be in the Nation of Islam. So it was very confusing for me.
How did you reconcile the two?
I think I just, whenever it came up, I just bowed out of the conversation.
Ah, okay.
I really wanted to be in the Nation of Islam, but I never challenged anybody who called him the hypocrite. I just ignored it and you know, either changed the subject or moved on to somewhere.
You always had an ability to compartmentalize your life and kind of to take the good.
Well, it was very confusing for me. You know, that time was a very confusing time because I didn't know Mark Twain said, well, they credit Mark Twain for saying it. Mark Twain said that there's two important days, the two most important days of your life are the day you're born and the day you find out why you were born. I had not yet found my purpose in life, you know what I mean?
Right.
So that period was a very confusing period of time for me. And, you know, I don't really know it at that young age whether I was really equipped to reconcile those issues. I think I just put them out of my head when confronted with it. You know what I mean? But it was a very confusing time for me because other than Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X was basically the sole reason why I was interested in the Nation of Islam. yet they call this man a hypocrite, and he's one of the reasons I'm in the Nation of Islam. So it was very confusing.
Wow. What was it about Malcolm's, the biography of Malcolm? You know more, you didn't know him personally, but you knew his knew him through the autobiography. What about the autobiography? You're not in the streets. You put,
well,
like,
I really didn't read that. I was introduced to Malcolm through his record albums, Ballads of the Bullet. So I really didn't read the books that influenced me growing up negatively was Man-Child in the Promised Land by Claude Brown and
yes,
the Lucky Luciano story. You know what I mean? So I really
Iceberg Slim didn't have any influence upon you, huh?
Yeah, Iceberg Slim too. Yes, but Malcolm, we used to listen to Malcolm's albums. And
okay.
And are you there?
I'm here. Yes, sir.
Yeah, we used to listen to Malcolm's albums all the time, and so you know Malcolm's albums were from when he was in the Nation of Islam. Like I told you,
right?
In 1967, when I went to the Nation of Islam. Or got interested in the Nation of Islam, should I say? Malcolm had already been dead for 2 years.
Yes, sir.
You
know? So you joined the Nation of Islam at what age? What age was it that you joined the Nation of Islam?
Well, I first started going to the math in 1967, I believe it was. So that was what, 15? Probably 69
mm-hmm.
is when I actually, you know, started getting my ex.
So you had been interested in Islam. Was it anything other than Malcolm that influenced you? I mean, were people in Philadelphia Muslims? How did you come in contact with any individuals in Philadelphia?
Yes, it was one brother. It was a brother. His name was William 44X. And
mm-hmm.
he was one of the brothers involved in that Hanafi thing in Washington years later. But he used
yes,
to
sir.
Stand in front of the state store in the Pantry Pride in, on Stanton and Washington Lane in Philadelphia. And I was so impressed. I had, you know, like we used to dress to impress, you know, but we used to wear casual stuff, you know, blonde sweaters and kaleidoscope sweaters and scaparelli
yes,
shirts.
Sir.
To see a brother in a three-piece suit every day and selling papers and steaks from the Blue Diamond Meat Company. I was very impressed with this brother. His name was William 44, and he was very influential as far as talking to us young guys about the Nation of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
But I had already had interest in him in the Nation based on Malcolm and Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. So you were predisposed. So did you start attending the temple?
Say that again.
Did you start attending the temple at that point?
Yes.
Okay. And at that point, you began to formally join. How did you then?
Yeah.
How did you get in with the circle of people who also were? I would say they were doing a double dance. They would
For a long time, I kind of hesitated to go in the Nation because I knew I was dirty. So, what happened was it was just certain people had a certain mentality. And like I said, they weren't the majority of the people. They were a small segment that was very influential in the Nation.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
those guys were much older than me, so I was very impressed by them. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. I was probably in my teens, and they were, if not in their
mm-hmm.
30s, probably close to their 30s. So, you know, they
were
kind of
much younger. Yes.
Yeah. So they were very influential in that respect because we kind of looked up to them because
mm-hmm.
you know they were everybody in Philly feared and respected them. You know what I mean?
Mm. Did you see the exhibition about humanity, as you put it in your book of the reality? What kind of person was?
Well, you got to remember, a lot of my book, I'm talking from hindsight. You know, I'm talking as a person who went through all that, and now I can look back upon it. So, you know, from hindsight, you know, they say hindsight is 20/20. From hindsight, I know exactly what I was going through, what happened to me, or whatever, but not while I was in real time. You know what I mean?
Yes.
When I was in the moment. You know.
Right. No, I definitely understand. Okay, now you're 15, you're in a high school. You also got one foot in the Nation of Islam. What is your school life like?
I was pretty good in school. I was probably, I write in my book, if I had to pass by studying, I would have never passed. I just naturally just caught on stuff, you know what I mean? So I never really studied. I just had I don't even know how to explain it. I could just pass my courses and stuff. When I was
did you turn your homework in?
I guess I did. I passed. I know I didn't go to school serious. I can tell you that.
Now, what was your home life like? What was your home life like while you were in high school?
I was a child. I had a single parent. My mother, at that time, my grandmother raised me till I was 14, and then I moved to Philly with my mother when I was 14.
Where was your father at?
My father died when I was 13.
Oh, okay. And then the two years later you began to. Did you ever grow up with your father?
No, my father and mother broke up when I was 3.
Okay. Did you see him any time during that period until he passed?
Probably the 3 years before. I'm only guessing. Probably from the age 10 to 13 when he passed. Probably those three years.
Okay, you had a vague memory of him, but the strongest influence was your grandmother and your mother.
Right. He didn't really have any influence on him. No.
Right. Did you have uncles or any other male relatives?
No. Not that I looked up to. I looked up to the guys in the street that were a little older than me.
Okay. So they became sort of like father figures. They were similar to your coaches. I think you mentioned in your early part of your book, if I remember, coaches that you really identified with when you were living in Greenville.
Right.
Until the coming
right.
of the coach that came in and kind of change your whole perception of fairness, I believe. Will you speak on that?
Yeah. Well, what happened was I ended up leaving East Orange and playing for the Bloomfield Pal, which was back then a white working class environment, and it was basically a all white team, and it was like four of us from East Orange. Black kids from East Orange that played for him. And we had a coach, Joe Reach. He was very impressive. I mean, he's probably the first Caucasian I ever met that color had really, that I could honestly say color didn't mean anything to him. Actually, I don't really want to get stuck on my childhood because my book is about the evolution, the processes.
The only reason I looked at it because I wanted to set the background so we could move towards solving the riddle. Just to know pre Dr. Rotman and pre-Grayford. Then we would go into the rest of it. Because what I want to do is the next interview. This is a four-part interview. So I wanted people to get a background and a setting of who you are, what are the forces? Because sometimes the forces that we later on reform from is because we had a lot of good stuff in our background. We may not get to see it. And, of course, part of my interviewing process is that I'm hoping that this interview, 15-year-old young person that's going to be listening to this, and would just want you to talk to that 15-year-old guy, which is mainly a part of our audience. I just want to let you know the audience we let. We're reaching mostly young
people. That's the good thing about people like us, that we can – the one of the things that we can do with young people is young people don't have the ability to speak from hindsight, and we can.
Right.
So,
I intend to bring Kevin Childs and some of the big gangbangers that – been in Washington and Philly. One of the things we have in this part of our ministry is Urban Peace. Is we want to bring people that have already overcome these situations. We want to ask them to speak to a 14-year-old guy walking around the streets of East Florida, Linden or Broadway or any city in America. And just a lot of these guys don't have any perspective because nobody gave it to them. You know what I'm saying?
No.
I tell people, even as a parent, most difficult years of my life was my first child because I didn't know what it was to be a father, even though I had a father in my home. But nobody consciously told me this is what you do. So we're gonna continue this. This is with God's permission. We got about 5 more minutes of this show. We're gonna do this, and we're gonna 2 weeks from now, and we're going to continue this program to interview you. So tell us, like, in 5 minutes, maybe, let's take 3 minutes to kind of sum up what some of you talk about. That's what you like to talk about, free time.
Well, basically, you and I started talking. You read my book, Solving the Riddle. And basically, what that book is, what I try to do in that book is to show that, and I use my life as an example to show that there are points in your life that you get certain hints, certain riddles, certain things that you have to figure out. I say there's questions that must be answered, mysteries that must be solved, and meaning given to both of them. So at some point, everybody has to encounter that, whether they grew up in the streets or they grew up in a penthouse or Fifth Avenue. At some point in your life, you have to figure out, getting back to Mark Twain, why you were born. You know what I mean? What was your purpose in life? Why were you here? So, you have to figure out those things for yourself in order to grow and develop into who you end up becoming. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
So basically, it's not only do we evolve as human beings, but, how do we evolve? What are the stages? And those stages are, at each point in those stages of growth and development, you have to figure life out. So you have to solve life as a riddle. You have to solve it because, even from an Islamic standpoint, the term they use for a verse is ayat, which means signs. So everything in life is a sign that you have to somehow read, figure out, and how it applies to you, and how it determines who you become. And that's basically what this journey is about, being able to pinpoint those certain signs and solve those riddles as you travel through the ladder of life.
Right,
and you're right.
That's a very powerful. You obviously have found purpose, and I would say enthusiastically, you can help a lot of people to solve the riddle of down lives, because life is a riddle. It is really full of finding out meaning. I mean, some of us don't wake up till we're 60. Some wake up at 50. You know, we pray that. Young people, I tell young people all the time, I don't want you to be like the carpenter ant. I mean, I want you to be smarter than the carpenter ant. I learned this, that the carpenter ant, if one of them get knocked off, they break the colony off and they never come back. And what we do is we see that the carpenter
Do you remember what Muhammad Ali said? He said, if you're 50 years old and you still think like you were when you were 20, you've wasted 30 years of your life.
And he is 100% right. But how many grown men we know are walking around, I mean, they dress like they were 15 and 20. I mean, the guy's still got a ponytail and the top of his head is bald. And he's walking around with some, what I think those expensive sneakers, Yeezys or Air Jordans. And he's walking, he's got arthritis, all kinds of other problems, but he still acts as though he's 15 or 16 years old. As far as I say, I don't want to grow up. So we're speaking with Dr. Kevin Abdul-Rahman, PhD from the Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the author of Solving the Riddle, and we will have him back on week after next to discuss solving the riddle. In fact, we're going to also open up the mic to Doctor. At some point, we would even like for Doctor to host some of these shows and bring some of your students on. You have a large repertoire of students. You are a youth worker, youth intervention work. We're going to talk a lot more about your work. So with your permission, we're going to have maybe 6 to 8 weeks of presenting you. We're going to go chapter by chapter, point by point. There's so much in your life that's rich that could save a lot of people's lives, and a guy won't have to go through experimenting. You know, I mean, I talked to a lot of young people who say, I didn't know myself. So I had to do 20 years in the federal penitentiary. And when I got in the federal penitentiary, an OG pulled me to one guy I was talking about. He said when he got into one of the USPs, as soon as he got in, he was just lucky to fall in with a guy who was doing life. And the guy pulled his coat and told him, so you can hang around and do what everybody else is doing, or you can go to the law library and learn something. And he learned something. So we're here to save people's lives. We don't use religion in the sense of the ritualistic stuff that benefits us. First of all, become a Muslim, we're certainly here to help them. Want to make a station break and say, just before I have our brother to close out with us, is that tomorrow we will be on the air on Blog Talk Radio at 3 o'clock, where I will be given an address called The Time and What Must Be Done. And it really is, the subtitle is COVID-19 and the Age of Trump, Age of President Trump. So we're going to be discussing that issue, opening up the country, what should happen. This is what we think from our perspective. Obviously, we can't talk from anybody else's perspective. So we want you to tune in, same station, Blog Talk Radio, and you can get the link. We'll post it on Facebook. And I'm going to have Brother Dr. Kevin Abdul-Rahman to give us a closing statement.
You said a closing statement?
Yes, sir, doctor.
Well, again, I would basically say that, you know, I go back to the Mark Twain quote, and I say Mark Twain this. People say that was attributed to him, but he didn't really say it. But the two most important dates in your life is the day you're born and the day you find out why. And the day you find out why is when you're going to take off and become the person you are, once you find your purpose in life. And
well,
I want to thank you personally. I want to thank you personally for this hour or so of discussion. It was very helpful and very enthusiastic.
And I will also say to you, peace be on you, and Ramadan Mubarak. May you enjoy blessed Ramadan. And you certainly have been a blessing to our audience. I'm sure they have enjoyed it. And we will be back week after next. We have another guest next week.
All right.
We'll have you back. to talk with us. Thank you, Dr. Abdul Rahman. Peace be on you. As-salamu alaykum. Thank you.
Thank you, Mashallah. Take care.